You really want to be better with your finances. You try to put money away in savings. You look for deals. You wrote out a budget once a long time ago. Yet you still overdraft from time to time and you still have debt. The truth is, managing money is not easy, but Rocket Money can help. Rocket Money shows you exactly what you're spending every month. From there, the app helps you make a budget that meets your financial goals. The app even gives you real-time alerts when you're about to go over your budget so you don't spend too much. With Rocket Money, you can also see all of your subscriptions at a glance and cancel the ones you don't want right from the app. Rocket Money can even try to get you a refund for some of the money you wasted. Plus, you can use the smart savings feature to start putting more money away. Rocket Money analyzes your accounts to determine the optimal time to stow away cash without going over your budget. Our members report that the Rocket Money app saved them more than $700 a year. Getting better with money doesn't have to be a pipe dream. Rocket Money can make it a reality. Go to rocketmoney.com/cancel or download the app from the Apple app or Google Play stores.
Coda just made riding the bus easier than ever. Now you can pay your Coda fare by tapping your smartphone, smartwatch, or card, just like you do at the coffee shop or grocery store. Love paying with smart card? Keep doing that. Have a pass? Still works perfectly. Want to tap your phone? Now you can do that too. It's just one more way to move your way with Coda. Get moving now with Tap to Pay. Learn more at coda.com/tap.
Where are you starting if you start from scratch?
Did anyone ever actually bury the hatchet?
And why would you have a feather in your cap?
Ride shotgun with us as we find out who a son of a gun really is, learn why things go pear-shaped, and reveal the skeletons in the closets of common idioms on this episode of Words Unraveled.
Welcome to another Words Unraveled. I'm Rob Watts from the YouTube channel Rob Words.
And I'm Jess DeFerris, author of etymology books, including Useless Etymology. And today we are back with idioms. This is a recurring topic for us, isn't it?
It is, yeah. We like to get to the bottom of where well-known sayings, proverbs, adages actually came from. It usually involves a bit of debunking some false theories and also just telling the stories of the origins of some of those things we just say some of the time.
Yes, indeed. We have talked about food-related idioms. One of our more popular episodes was about generalized idioms. And I brought a kind of a mixed bag here today.
Yeah, mine is also a potluck of sayings and proverbs. But where do we start? I mean, let's go into this all guns blazing, Jess.
Yes, indeed.
I hear you've got a few ballistic idioms for us.
I absolutely do. I have a bit of a violent batch of idioms here. And part of it is because I was on a Massachusetts radio show the other day and they warned me ahead of time that I needed to keep it clean. So I didn't bring that much naughty stuff to the table, but the person who was interviewing me asked me specifically about the origin of the phrase son of a gun. And he had a common folk etymology explanation about this origin or about this idiom. But the actual explanation, I think, is pretty cool too. So the supposed origin of son of a gun is that when women would accompany their spouses at sea with the Royal Navy, again, we usually start with the nautical origins, and some of them
weird?
Are true.
People are so desperate to attribute things to nautical life. Oh, I think you'll find it is a nautical term. I mean, I don't know why. It's definitely the way in which things are most commonly falsely attributed.
And to be fair, many idioms are nautical in origin, but they're not the ones with the like tidy personal stories. And this is one of them. So anyway, women would accompany their spouses at sea with the Royal Navy. They'd be given a space between the cannons on a ship to give birth and rest with their child. And this was repeated in the 19th century by naval writers, including Admiral William Henry Smith, who wrote in his 1867 Sailor's Word Book that a son of a gun is, quote, an epithet conveying contempt in a slight degree and originally applied to boys born afloat when women were permitted to accompany their husbands to sea. One admiral declared he literally was thus cradled under the breast of a gun carriage. Unfortunately, the chronology does not track.
Right. What do you mean?
Dictionaries typically explain it as a minced variation of son of a bitch. Like, that's probably it. And in some cases, it might intentionally be used to imply a soldier's son, perhaps born out of wedlock while this fellow is away at war. But it might also just be that gun is a rough around the edges, but still polite alternative for naughtier terms. And critically, it rhymes with sun.
Oh, yeah. 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 Like, never underestimate the power of assonance. You know, you get those two repeated vowel sounds, people will go for it.
One of the earliest instances is in the humorous periodical, The British Apollo from 1720s. And there's a little poem that goes, "You Apollo's son, you're a son of a gun, made up with bamboozle, you'll directly I'll puzzle." And it's just, it's in silly rhymes and things. And there may in many cases, and according to the Gentleman's Magazine in 1787, it could mean a soldier's child in some cases, but probably originally it's just that it rhymes.
I have some idioms related to other weapons, but have you got any more to do with guns and the like?
Oh, I've got tons of guns.
Tons of guns.
I want to mention this because someone will mention it if I don't. There's one more son of a gun theory that absolutely is not true. And it's that feudal knights would call people who used guns in the early days of firearms son of a gun as an insult because it was a less noble weapon. But we don't have any chronological evidence of that.
Okay, fair enough.
Another actual nautical one, this one's relatively satisfying, is loose cannon. And this one, you might be able to predict this one. When someone is a loose cannon, you're comparing their behavior to one of the more dangerous accidents that can happen aboard a warship. The cannons can come unlashed and start bashing things around on rough seas.
Yeah, presumably you don't want a cannon to be loose, whether you're on a boat or not, right?
Right.
Every time it fires, it's going to...
Victor Hugo was the reason it spread. In 1874, he published the novel 93, which contains an extended dramatic chapter about a cannon that snaps loose during a storm, and that probably transported it into the public imagination, where it became this idiom that we use now. One of my favorite things about idioms is that they are often, it's not too much of a mystery why they became commonly used and what they mean, but the way they entered common parlance is kind of interesting. Smoking gun is another one. It was originally the literal image of the murderer standing over the body with the recently fired weapon, and Arthur Conan Doyle's story, The Adventure of the Glorious Scott, where a shipboard chaplain holds a smoking pistol beside a dead man, is where we first get that. But then the Watergate scandal's idiomatic use of a smoking gun around Nixon is why we started using it more commonly now.
And is there a similar explanation behind being caught red-handed to the smoking gun? The idea is you turn up and you find the murderer with the evidence right there in front of them, either in the form of the smoking barrel of a gun or the bloodied hand. Is that where it comes from?
Yes, and it dates back to the 1470s. The idiom caught red-handed comes from Scottish criminal law. Taken red hand appears in the 1470s, and then court records through the 1500s and 1600s repeated that phrasing for homicide and then for poaching and livestock killing. And then Sir Walter Scott used red-handed, the sort of shortened form, to reach a wider readership in 1819 in Ivanhoe. I'm running with these. You need to take over after this.
I'm enjoying them. Keep going. Fire a whole volley of them at me.
I got more. But smoking gun and caught red-handed pair nicely, I think, with in flagrante delicto, which also dates back to medieval Latin legal discourse, and it means in blazing offense. So rather than weaponry, we kind of have the notion of arson.
Right. Yeah.
What weaponry do you have on hand?
Well, so I was thinking about having strings to one's bow and whether or not we're talking about, I don't know, a violin bow, which has strings on it, or we're talking about a bow and arrow. And yes, we are talking about a bow and arrow here. But here's something interesting. What does the phrase to have a string to your bow or another string to your bow, what does that mean to you, Jess? Because I'm just wondering if I've been misunderstanding it my whole life.
That's not an idiom that comes up that much to me.
When I've heard it used, and when I've used it myself, it's been to mean that you've got another skill, right? You've got, oh, there's another string to your bow. It's something else that you're very good at. And it doesn't actually quite mean that. I mean, it does nowadays, but that is an extrapolation from where it originally came from.
That sounds like a violin to me.
It's a bow and arrow because the idea that it's evoking is that you've got a second string on your bow meaning that if your first string snaps, you've still got a backup. So having many strings to your bow means that you have got many options. You've got many backup plans, as it were. So rather than it being that you've got many skills, it's more like you've got skills to fall back on should something go wrong with your, you know, your main form of employment. Let me find you an example of it from the records. Yeah, okay, from 1524. This is actually from the state papers of Henry VIII, which I think is quite interesting. And it recommends having two strings to your bow, especially when one is wrought with a woman's fingers. So basically, the idea is that a woman would make a weaker string.
Oh.
And therefore, yeah, it's important to have a second string. It's an extension of the ideas, is that you need to have an extra string to your bow in case a weaker string snaps.
Ah, I see.
Apparently women make rubbish string. that's what they used to say in Henry VIII's day.
It does take a lot of power to string a bow because you have to be able to bend, especially a particularly rigid bow.
Yeah, you've got to be strong. But then I sort of was hopping around similar phrases. And another one is a feather in your cap.
Ooh, yeah.
Right, which presumably you have heard. And, you know, it's, again, if someone says there's a feather in your cap, it's what is it? It's as though, oh, you've achieved something there that you can, you know, it's almost like, oh, there's another thing you can pop on your CV.
Yeah.
Isn't it? That's how I think of a lot of these things. And feather in the cap comes from a genuine practice across multiple cultures of putting feathers in caps as marks of achievement. But specifically, one of the earliest, in fact, the earliest reference to it that I found was from 1599. So that's a long time ago, in a description of Hungarian culture by a guy called Richard Hansard, who wrote, "It hath been an ancient custom among them," the Hungarians, "that none should wear a feather but he who had killed a Turk,
ooh,
to whom it was lawful to show the number of his slain enemies by the number of feathers in his cap." So to have another feather in your cap is to have killed another Turk, right? And to be able to show that fact off. But there are other cultures that have also shown achievement by sticking feathers in their caps.
I wonder what the maximum amount of feathers allowed would be. Like, when do you just start looking like a peacock?
I mean, I'm staying away from the guy who looks like a peacock. Lest he slay me too. I was also thinking about all these things about having more or less of something. And what about too many irons in the fire? I was thinking, well, what does that talk about? Is it a pressing iron? No, it's not a pressing iron. It's from blacksmithing. It's from the idea of, so you could have multiple irons in the fire. So you'd be working on multiple projects, basically. But if you have too many in the fire, one of them can get burnt, because you can actually burn iron to the point where it becomes unworkable. So that's the idea of having too many irons in the fire. And there's also, while we're on irons, strike while the iron is hot is also from blacksmithing. You perhaps know this, but it's the idea that, you know, you need to hammer your iron into shape while it is still hot. And actually, the earliest citation in the dictionary for that is Geoffrey Chaucer, which is from 1405. And he wrote, "Right, so as while that iron is hot, men should smite." So the idea is smite when the iron is hot.
That's neat. I bet there are a lot more blacksmithing idioms out there.
We could definitely do another episode where it's just idioms from traditional trades, I'm sure.
Your archery-themed idiom reminded me of loophole. You know, the original loophole. Have we talked about this before?
No, we haven't actually.
Excellent. In Middle English, a loop was a narrow slit, L-O-U-P-E, was a narrow slit in a wall, especially a vertical opening in a fortification that allowed archers or musketeers to fire at the enemy while staying protected. It's a Dutch-related word, so it's not. I was like, well, that sounds like wolf or something with loop.
Yeah.
But the loop here is a slit-like opening. And in medieval Latin and Middle Dutch, we have other words meaning to peer or to look through things or slit-like openings. And the first fortification sense appears in 1591 with writers talking about defenders appearing at their defenses or loopholes during a siege, and it was extended in a figurative sense relatively quickly after that, including like gaps in laws and contracts and obligations as early as like the 1660s, which I think is kind of neat.
That is neat. That is going to change the image in my head now when I hear the idea of a loophole. So essentially what a loophole is sort of a trace gap through which you can actually fire a shot.
Yeah, absolutely. The OED also has a moralistic example from 1664 that says leaving loopholes in your soul, presumably some moralistic gaps in your your moral armor.
Yeah, through which someone can fire.
Allowing some sin to
yeah,
creep
exactly.
through. I don't think we've done probably one of the more famous ones that people like to talk about. And it does have the satisfying origin that everyone quotes, and it's Bury the Hatchet.
Right, yeah. Tell us about Bury the Hatchet.
It comes from a real diplomatic custom practiced among some North American indigenous nations, especially within the Iroquois Confederacy, where presumably the record of this is very much oral. So whether this was actually done or not, it's a little hard to tell. But the notion is that warring nations might agree to peace by symbolically and physically interring war axes or tomahawks under the ground.
I like that. Another one that I came across while I was researching, but I didn't go into too deeply into it, was the idea of flying off the handle, which does come from the idea of an axe head flying off its handle. I think it comes from a specific war. I can't remember which one, maybe the American Civil War, something like that, where they had particularly unreliable axes that would fly off the handle. I don't understand that. I mean, so that is the explanation, but I don't understand how you actually get from that idea to the idea of losing your temper.
Maybe you're so angry that you fling it out.
Maybe.
You're the figure it out.
More exploration required on that one, I think. I've got one while we're talking about military procedures, I suppose. So I don't know how widely known it is that a muster, as in to pass muster, is a military inspection. Did you know that?
I knew that passing muster meant an inspection of some kind, and muster also makes sense as a collection of... That's what I would have guessed. I haven't thought through this.
The actual idea of the muster isn't the gathering. So we've extrapolated the idea of mustering people together because a muster requires you to gather people together. This word exists in lots of other languages, lots of other European languages. For example, in German, you have muster. But in other languages, muster does not mean what it means in English.
Okay, it doesn't mean a gathering.
It does not. It means a sample. So for example, if I go to buy a carpet here in Germany, they will give me a muster, right? Which will be a little sample of the carpet or anywhere you go. And in most languages where you find a word along the lines of muster with the same etymology, it means some sort of example or template or something like that. And that's because it comes from the Latin verb for to show, the same Latin verb that gives the French word montre, right? Or montrer, which means to show, and from which we eventually get muster, because in Old French it was a monstre, and then you end up with it in English as monster and then muster. So yes, this is the surprising bit. It's that mustering together is so-called because a muster is a demonstration, not because... what have I done here? Hold on. Let me get this straight. So mustering people together is so called because at a muster you have to gather people together, not because mustering people together is what you do to do a muster.
Oh, interesting. So it's a kind of reverse, the reverse of what I would have assumed.
Yeah, exactly. That's what I'm trying to get. Thank you, Jess.
Yeah.
That's what I mean. Explained it clear as mud.
One of my favorite opportunities that anyone on TikTok ever gave me is I get asked questions about specific words. Somebody commented, "Why is there a demon in demonstrate?" And I was like, "Well, there isn't a demon in demonstrate, but there is a monster in it." I love that one. And it's because like monster means like pointing at something and being like, "Oh God, what is that thing?"
Yeah. So thank you. You've brought it back round to that. That's another example of the use of that old French word that meant to show. And so, yeah, made it into military circles. Not just military, just inspections in general, called musters. Yeah, because you had to show yourself off. I feel like I should also here mention another idiom, which is to cut the mustard. So here's the interesting thing about that, because I mention it because a lot of people think that cut the mustard is a misunderstanding of cut the muster,
right,
or to cut muster. It is not. It really is about mustard, but it's not about the condiment, the finished condiment mustard. It's about the mustard plant.
Oh. And
yeah, the mustard plant, when it grows very tall, can be tricky to harvest. So to be able to cut the mustard is, you know, having the ability to harvest this quite difficult crop.
And I never would have
examples of it being used to. No, exactly. So 1884, it is difficult to find men tall enough to see to cut mustard. So, you know, it is to cut mustard and then to cut the mustard that comes a little bit later. And by the way, one more mustardy one, mustard strong. So mustard strong comes from the same poem as another idiom that we have described in the past, which was cool as a cucumber. Do you remember this story? There is this one poem called A New Song of New Similes by John Gay, published in 1732, in which he just coined simile after simile after simile. And actually the very first one in that poem is, my passion is as mustard strong. And that's where we get the idea of something being mustard strong. And then later on, he talks about being cool as a cucumber.
Mustard, as we've discussed before, is named for at least that ARD ending, which is an intensifier, is named for its intensity of flavor.
We need some sort of like ARD bell for when these things come up. Because it's so worth a mention, isn't it? Yeah, this musty fellow with a right mustard.
The mustard bell. Maybe we've just coined a new idiom. Ring the mustard bell. I love it.
Ring the mustard bell. What would it mean?
Bring up that one idiom or that one ending.
That's it. Yeah.
Think about the last time you had to cancel a subscription. There's probably some waiting on hold, some guessing at your password, some mind-numbing small talk. And maybe, after all of that, you still weren't able to cancel it. Good news, it doesn't have to be this way, thanks to Rocket Money. Rocket Money tracks, manages, and can cancel your subscriptions for you. When you connect your accounts, you'll see a complete picture of all of your recurring subscriptions all in one place. Rocket Money organizes your subscriptions by due date and notifies you when something is coming up, so you'll never be caught off guard when you get charged. If you see a subscription you want to cancel, Rocket Money simplifies the process. Instead of waiting on hold for an hour, you can cancel it right from the app. Rocket Money will even try to get you a refund for the money you spent on subscriptions you forgot about. Stop wasting time trying to cancel subscriptions the hard way. Make your life easier and go to rocketmoney.com/cancel. That's rocketmoney.com/cancel, or download the app from the Apple App or Google Play Stores.
Coda just made riding the bus easier than ever. Now you can pay your Coda fare by tapping your smartphone, smartwatch, or card, just like you do at the coffee shop or grocery store. Love paying with smart card? Keep doing that. Have a pass? Still works perfectly. Want to tap your phone? Now you can do that too. It's just one more way to move your way with Coda. Get moving now with Tap to Pay. Learn more at coda.com/tap.
A food-related idiom that also pertains to guns, since I'm just firing them off continually.
Please do. Is it a fusillade? There we go. That's firing a load of things off at once.
Have you come across the phrase "guns and butter"?
Actually, no. That's a new one to me.
It was big in World War II era discussions, and then thereafter too, through the Cold War as well. It's an economic and political slogan. It's unfortunately it's Nazi garbage, but it comes from a 1936 speech by Nazi Minister of Propaganda Joseph Goebbels, who framed Germany's resource choices as a trade-off between guns, military spending, and butter, meaning civilian goods. And then English newspapers picked up the phrase the following year, and LBJ used it when reporting on the state of national defense and the economy. So guns and butter it's standard shorthand for government budgeting decisions that balance military investment with domestic spending. And it also inspired a macroeconomic model. The guns versus butter model demonstrates the relationship between a nation's investment in defense versus civilian goods. So a little bit, I don't know, inside baseball on that one, but it does come up a lot, especially maybe in maybe pertinent to the US military spending.
I'm really glad you mentioned that one, actually, because it leads me on to another one, which is a thing and thing, a food and a thing to do someone harm with. And that is the phrase carrot and stick. I think you can break the world up into people who think carrot and stick means one of two things, right? So there are people who think carrot and stick approach is both beating with the stick and feeding the carrot to the donkey. The donkey's involved in both.
Yeah.
And then there's others who think that it's about like sticking a stick on the donkey's head with a carrot on the end of it.
That is my mental image, yes.
Is that your mental image? That was my mental image too. So we are wrong insofar as like the original idea of it.
Now that you say it.
Yeah, it does seem silly. So that idea of you know, the stick with the carrot on the end of it, yes, it comes from cartoons. You know, that is where it goes. It goes back a long way. It goes back to the 1800s, but it is later than the origin of the idea of carrot and stick being to achieve something, to encourage through both violence, but sort of force and, you know, more benevolent coercion. And actually, one of the best quotes to explain it is Churchill. And it's a real quote from Churchill for a change.
Hey!
But again, we're back in the Second World War. We're back with the Nazis. And it's 1938. And Winston Churchill writes a letter that's become known as the Rape of Austria, because that's how he describes the Nazis marching into Austria, where they're welcomed, you know, and they managed to seize control of Austria with great ease. And he's writing this in 1938, so this is before Britain joins the war. It's before the Nazis invade Poland. This is like a really big victory for them. And he writes in this letter, "Thus, by every device, from the stick to the carrot, the emaciated Austrian donkey is made to pull the Nazi barrow up an ever-steepening hill." It's a really vivid image. And it's about how the Nazis both suck up to the Austrian people, but at the same time, they oppress them to feed their own war machine. So, yeah, carrot and stick. I still think I'm going to think of the donkey, which, by the way, it doesn't work, putting a carrot on the end of a stick in front of a donkey. Apparently, the donkey ain't going to go nowhere.
Donkeys are pretty smart and very mean, so I think that sounds like a good way to just get bit.
They work it out pretty fast. Donkeys were a real favorite etymology of mine, by the way, because it's one of those ones we don't know. And I don't know if we actually got around to mentioning it in our episode about Francis Grosser's Dictionary of the Vulgar Tongue, because that's the first place that the word donkey is found. And no one knows where it came from before that. It's one of these words he picked up in, I don't know, the criminal underworld, who knows. But he spells it D-O-N-K-E-Y, but it's pronounced, it's believed, donkey. And he spelt it like that to reflect the spelling of monkey. Because the leading theory as to where the word donkey comes from, or donkey indeed, is that it's a diminutive, it's a cutesy version of the name Duncan.
Ah,
yeah, yeah.
That's cute.
Because, you know, we call them jackasses. So Jack is a name. They've been called donkey dicks. and they've been called neddies. You know, these are all, we like to call these hardworking companions the names of people. So the leading theory about where donkey comes from is that it's a cute version of the name Duncan.
And Duncan means like dark too, which to describe a donkey's fur as dun would also make sense. Little dun thing.
Oh, that's interesting. Yeah. Because the German word for dark is dunkel. Anyway, that was a sidestep from the carrot and stick. But anyway, you wanted to go somewhere after your guns and butter.
I have endless gun idioms, apparently. I could really quickly fire off three more, and then we can move on to less violent topics. I think this one's worth mentioning just because it's fun. It's probably pretty obvious. The idiom ride shotgun grew from a real frontier job in 19th century American Western contexts. Stagecoaches that carried payroll or mail or passengers usually had an armed guard who sat beside the driver with a shotgun or rifle. But of course, how common that was, maybe a little overblown, probably by the fact that in the 1880s, Western fiction started taking off. We've got these serialized frontier stories mentioning guards of the shotgun seat of stagecoaches. And then in the 1890s, more Western novels and fiction comes out. So then the shotgun seat became the side seat of any car. Another gun one, which I think is kind of neat, under the gun comes from poker, where a player, again, I don't know very much about poker. Do you know this?
we learned this from our episode about card games and such that neither of us has got a clue how to play them.
Did we talk about under the gun?
No.
Oh, okay, great. All right. Well, the poker. I'm going to say this, and I'm going to hope it's right. The player who acts first on each betting round sits under the gun, and the notion is working under intense pressure or expectation or scrutiny, which is pretty obvious, but apparently it was popularized via poker. In that position, the player must make decisions with no information, which increases the immediate pressure.
Right. I haven't heard the phrase under the gun. So is that what it means? It means to be under pressure. Like, I'm really under the gun.
Yeah, that's really common, at least in the contexts that I roam.
Yeah, what would I hear? I've heard there's a similar one, isn't there? Under the cosh is something that we sometimes say, which I guess is at risk of being punished, I suppose, in some way. That sort of pressure.
The next level of intensity after under the gun would be under fire, where you're actively dodging problems as they come your way.
Might have a sword hanging over you at the same time as well, although we know where that comes from.
Yeah.
That's from the tale of Damocles.
I do have a way to get us off of weapons now, and it's through dead bodies. Skeletons in closets.
Oh.
The idiom, a skeleton in the closet, came about during the early 19th century as a way to talk about, as we know, a family secret without naming it. But the way it was popularized and the associations around it are kind of neat. William Makepeace Thackeray wrote in Punch, there is a skeleton in every house. And then also in his book, The Newcomes, he expanded the phrasing to a skeleton or two in their closets. And this is the first recorded instances we have of that arrangement of words. But it's probably a callback to Bluebeard, which, do you know Bluebeard's story?
No, tell me.
So Charles Perrault wrote The Tale of Bluebeard in 1697, and it's about this man who kept marrying women and killing them and hanging their corpses on his walls in the closet or in a room. And the story is about one of his wives who discovers the dead women. And the story was so popular that the OED and Merriam-Webster list a man who murders his wives as a definition of the word bluebeard dating back to the 1700s. And bluebearding is listed in some sources as the crime of either killing a series of women or seducing and abandoning a series of women. And then, of course, the serial killer who is covered in Devil in the White City by Eric Larson was also called Bluebeard. Oh. Well, he killed a number of people, not just women, but some of his wives he would roast alive and put in the walls. Yay!
We get back to weapons.
Yeah.
No. While we're talking about the underworld, you know, and nasty folk, can we talk about Devil's Advocate? Because I want to look this up and see if there'd ever actually been like a devil's advocate, a lawyer for the devil. And it was, I mean, it is kind of what it means, right? So the idea of the devil's advocate goes really, really far back. I mean, at least 1600s, you've got, he is like unto the devil's advocate, for he pleadeth for nothing but for the kingdom of Satan. That's a quotation in the OED from 1616. And the idea there being that this person is literally the devil's advocate. And how are they the devil's advocate? Because they're advocating, they are defending the indefensible. They are pleading in favor of bad actions, right? To put it in the simplest possible terms. However, the Catholic Church adopted in, I don't know, I could only find reference to it from the 1700s, but I guess the practice must be maybe even older. It might even be where that apparently earlier meaning comes from. But the Catholic Church used to describe someone who argued against the canonization of a saint or argued against the validity of a miracle. They used to call those devil's advocates. I don't know if they still do in the Catholic Church. It's probably from that idea that we get the modern meaning of, you know, deliberately taking on the opposing argument just to test, you know, the strength of an argument. It perhaps comes from this idea from the Catholic church of having someone whose job it is to argue against whether or not this person should be a saint or whether or not this thing really was a miracle.
There are a lot of devil idioms. Most of them are relatively self-explanatory, like having the devil to pay and devil finds work for idle hands. And devil may care is a little bit interesting. It's the idea that the devil is a hypothetical entity who might care about consequences, whether the speaker does or not.
Because the word devil, it doesn't necessarily have to mean the devil, right? A devil can just be a sort of, you know, I don't know, like a pixie or something. You know, it's a demon.
In effect, it says that, you know, no one worth worrying about it cares at all in this situation, this hypothetical situation. Another neat one that I hadn't really thought through is the notion of between the devil and the deep blue sea. It kind of has sort of a Scylla and Charybdis energy to it. You run into a dilemma where both available options are dangerous, and there are also similar proverbs and things throughout history about like a precipice ahead and wolves behind. And the English version of this is the devil in the deep blue sea.
In this case, the devil represents the devil, or does it represent like death?
Anything very bad.
Well, and also the devil pops up in a lot of places, as you might expect, in other forms, but you know, in words like references to Nick, we've talked about this a lot.
Yeah.
It tends to be references to the devil, for example. So there are many more devil idioms than perhaps are immediately apparent.
A lot of them come from sort of using the devil or invoking the devil as an emphatic expletive, like the devil you will, and the devil and all, and a devil of a time.
Mm-hmm. You dirty devil. That's one.
Right. Uh-huh. There you go.
From the depths of hell, Jess, can you give us some heart with some heart idioms? Because you've been looking into those.
Well done. Yes, I have. The wonderful thing about heart-related idioms is that it keeps moving around. It shifts a lot. You can
have your heart on your sleeve, right?
Your heart can be in your boots. It can be in your throat. It can be in your mouth. It can be on your tongue throughout history. Oh. So, and it can be in the right place.
That's where it's best.
That's where it's supposed to be.
Do we know why it moves around? They usually mean the same thing, more or less?
Because it is treated as the seat of life and mind and will. And in the past, more intellectual power was associated with the heart as much as emotional power. It was often considered the seat of mind and will, emotions, character, courage, conscience, things like that. So we've got things like the courage failing, so the heart drops into your shoes. And when your fear is rising, your heart climbs into your mouth. And it probably also, it echoes the actual feeling you get in your chest when you're feeling afraid or...
When you say you've got your heart in your throat, I don't know, that it does feel like that, doesn't it? It feels like everything's just sort of, oh my God, ba-bum, ba-bum, ba-bum.
Yeah, and yeah, you can literally feel your heartbeat. And when your heart drops when you're afraid, it almost feels like sort of that stomach dropping feeling, right?
Yeah, or when your heart sinks as well, you can really feel a sort of, oh, like the whole body sinks.
It's just leaping around all over the place in there.
Very, very mobile organ, it turns out.
When it's on your sleeve, though, that's, you probably don't want that, but it's just outside of the body. But the earliest record we have, like the earliest clear record of wearing your heart on your sleeve is in Othello, as a matter of fact. I will wear my heart on my sleeve for Dawes to peck at. And it conveys emotional openness and vulnerability, your feelings showing. But some instances, including Merriam-Webster, cites this as a possible actual origin is in medieval jousting, when you would wear a token of your lady love or a cause on your sleeve. You would wrap that scarf around your armored sleeve.
I suppose that does help explain why it's the sleeve of all things, because that Shakespeare quote is like, well, why his sleeve?
Realistically, armored knights probably didn't say they wore their heart on their sleeve, but it is probably a later allusion to that practice, even if it's romanticized.
Yeah, exactly. But that's exactly what we have done with the Renaissance, is romanticize it, or medieval periods. Yeah. Do you know a word that means when something is heart-shaped?
Like a heart-shaped box?
Yeah, or that anything kind of that is heart-shaped. Yeah. So I'm trying to obliquely lead us somewhere. with this because...
Are you trying to get us to pear-shaped?
I am.
Good. Yeah. Let's get there.
So something heart-shaped is...
Take a bite out of it.
Cardiform. Something that is pear-shaped is piriform. Actually, I don't know why we're not using this more. I say, it's all gone a bit piriform. Sounds actually rather more sophisticated than it's all
gone. I like that.
A bit pear-shaped. Yeah, so I had the pear-shaped one because you mentioned that you'd done weapons and thought, okay, so maybe some sort of military ones. And usually this one's thought to come from the Air Force, the British Air Force. In fact, it does come from the British Air Force. I mean, it's 20th century. It's not so mystical where this idea of pear-shaped comes from. And if you look at the early citations are in British Air Force, Royal Air Force, the RAF, in their publications, they refer to things going pear-shaped. What is sort of not 100% is what they're talking about going pear-shaped. But the generally accepted idea is that it comes from the idea of trying to do a loop-the-loop. And if you do a loop-the-loop badly, what you end up with is a pear shape. Right, which you can imagine. You don't get a nice circle. It all goes a bit, you stall maybe. You end up with maybe a little sort of peak at the top or whatever, an elongated thing. The idea of something going pear-shaped is, while you're out trying to just do a nice, neat maneuver, you cock it up a bit and it all goes pear-shaped. The earliest citation, now this interested me, in the OED, the earliest citation for this, it's from 1983, which is really recent, isn't it?
Yeah.
Can you think of the idea of something going pear-shaped? And it's probably, there's jolly nice RAF airmen from the Second World War coming. Or went a bit pear-shaped, ended up in the drink. but no, it's earliest citation from the 1980s. It seems unlikely to me that you would go 40 years without anyone writing this term down. So maybe it is as recent as that. But that citation is... There were two bangs very close together. The whole aircraft shook and things went pear-shaped very quickly after that. The controls ceased to work. The nose started to go down. So actually what that made me wonder about was whether or not the pear-shapedness was actually describing a stall. So you know how you could be ascending, but if you stall, you then very quickly change direction and you go downwards in a curve. I was thinking that's actually a bit more sort of, that reminds me of the top of a pear.
Yeah, I can see that.
My own theory.
That's really neat.
So things can all go a little bit piriform.
You know, another idiom that I discovered was a lot more recent than I would have expected is back to square one.
Oh, so is this to do with snakes and ladders? I just assumed it was.
Yeah. No, it is. It is. And I don't know. I thought it would be a lot older than that. But the OED is like, nope, it's snakes and ladders.
How old is snakes and ladders?
1952 is the first time we have this. In the Economic Journal, a writer compares a complicated argument to a game of snakes and ladders, with the reader repeatedly sent back to square one.
This fits in remarkably well with something that I was looking up as well, which was starting from scratch, right? Because that's what going back to square one is, isn't it? Is you have to start from scratch. Are you aware of this phrase, to start from scratch?
Yeah, wouldn't that be like baking?
Go on.
I guess it's idiomatic in that case too. So my thought was like starting from scratch implies to me starting a recipe from scratch. In that case, it would also still be idiomatic because that doesn't explain the scratch part.
Yeah, exactly. Right. So the scratch
what is the scratch part?
So it probably comes from sport. Precisely which sport is not that obvious because scratch has been used as the starting point in quite a lot of sports. It's been used in running races. So you'd start from scratch. Or, for example, boxing matches start at a scratch. So scratch usually means that it's just a line that's been etched into the floor, right? Literally like a scratch. There's also, in cricket, what's usually known as the crease has in the past been known as the scratch as well. But the idea, and golfers will know this very well, is that, starting from scratch in a running race, just as it does in golf, means starting without a head start, without an advantage, without some sort of handicap. When you start from scratch, the idea is not that you're necessarily going straight back to the start, is that you're having to start without any advantage whatsoever, without anything at all. So it's not quite the same as going back to square one, whereas I think I would have used it to mean exactly the same as going back to square one.
While you were saying that, I was thinking that up to scratch probably had something to do with this as well, and it appears to have come from boxing when the when the line was drawn at the ground, and to be up to scratch, you had to be, you'd be ready to go and ready to fight.
Yeah.
Which is neat.
Charles Dickens is quoted using this very phrase in one of his letters in 1843. Pray, as a member of the committee, come up to the scratch. So that is calling on someone to, you know, come into the ring, stand at the scratch with me, because this is where the bout is going to start. Let's, go on, come and have a go if you think you're hard enough, said in Dickensian verbiage.
Mm. Well, having fired off as many idioms as we have in this episode, I think we are ready to come to a close. I was going to say something idiomatic, and I just
Are we at square 100 on the...
Square
100 on the snakes and ladders board? I don't know. This has been a fun one, though, Jess. And, and every time we do these, they change the images in my head when I use a phrase or hear a phrase. And also they change how I use them, because once you know the origins, you know, sometimes you realize it's not quite the apposite image that you thought it once was. Strings to your bow, that one. That's changed something for me today.
Everybody always comes with the origin that they've heard in the comments too. And I like to read those. They're fun. The ones that we presented here are the ones cited by the OED and Merriam-Webster and such. So they tend to be the ones with the most evidence behind them. But I also like hearing the folk etymology versions too.
Yeah. And they're also, you know, some of these, the origin is not known. Maybe you hold it. Who knows? Thanks for joining us for another episode of Words Unraveled, and we'll catch you in the next one.
See you next time.
Coda just made riding the bus easier than ever. Now you can pay your Coda fare by tapping your smartphone, smartwatch, or card, just like you do at the coffee shop or grocery store. Love paying with smart card? Keep doing that. Have a pass? Still works perfectly. Want to tap your phone? Now you can do that too. It's just one more way to move your way with Coda. Get moving now with Tap to Pay. Learn more at coda.com/tap.
If you love to travel, Capital One has a rewards credit card that's perfect for you. With the Capital One Venture X card, you earn unlimited double miles on everything you buy. Plus, you get premium benefits at a collection of luxury hotels when you book on Capital One Travel. And with Venture X, you get access to over 1,000 airport lounges worldwide. Open up a world of travel possibilities with the Capital One Venture X card. What's in your wallet?
Terms apply. Lounge access is subject to change. See CapitalOne.com for details.